Here we are at the last session of the day, so thank you very much for all of you continuing to kind of attend and for your engagement going forward. I'd now like to introduce Mark Griffin, who's Head of Hydrogen Development for Scottish Power. So over to you, Mark.
Thanks, everybody. As Andrew was saying, thanks for staying the course. It's much appreciated, and thanks very much today. I've been invited here to talk to you about how at Scottish Power we're delivering our first green hydrogen projects. So just as a bit of a background, we've been developing our green hydrogen projects for just over 3.5 years now as a business entity within Scottish Power. Scottish Power, for background, we're the first UK utility to generate 100% renewable energy. So all the energy we produce, all the energy we supply, and in this instance, all the energy we use for producing green hydrogen comes from a renewable asset, whether that be on or offshore wind, or as a solar PV plant. So as a business, we're part of the Iberdrola global function. Iberdrola carries the same ethos, carries the same aspirations around decarbonisation, about being renewable energy generators, leading the market, and around playing a big part in the future fuel space. So what we do here in the UK, we're either learning from our colleagues in Spain, in the US, Australia, Japan, Brazil, about different technologies, whether that's simply green hydrogen production, whether that's green ammonia, whether that's e-methanol, e-SAF, which is becoming really interesting, green fertilizer, all those things we're involved in. So we're part of a hydrogen entity now. So we sit within the Scottish Power business, which is the UK arm of Iberdrola. But now, as a business, we're a standalone business within Scottish Power, and we're known now as Scottish Power Green Hydrogen. So you'll start to see that branding appear more and more now. But the chairman recognised, the Iberdrola chairman recognised, that if we want to be a major player in this space, we need to create our own entity, but also develop those processes, taking all the learnings from renewable energy generation, but being able to really make a stamp on this, but carry that globally as well. And forgive me, this slide just helps to paint the picture for what we're doing. Our hydrogen is solely green hydrogen, so we will only be producing green hydrogen via electrolysis. And I'm conscious that I'm just going to sweep through this, but basically we'll take our current existing 3.2 gigawatt PPA renewable assets to produce green hydrogen. And we'll then produce that, and we'll either we will either co-locate with the renewable generation asset, so on an onshore wind farm today, potentially in the future offshore, and then we will then utilise today's options around road haul, short distance pipeline, but also in the future to potentially look at how we distribute that over in larger scales, but also in further distances, working along with the projects such as H2 Caledonia, H2 Union, etc. So it's really, really important. So that's the basis. And when we look at our projects, and when we look at any project, we understand that there's going to be some things that are out of our control, but fundamentally there's either an industry, there's a region, or there's a single customer that wants to decarbonize and has done the due diligence, and they say green hydrogen is the answer for us. So we can do that in three ways. We can produce the renewable energy, as I mentioned before, in strategic locations all around the UK, on or offshore, and we can utilize the grid to get that energy to where the customer is to produce the hydrogen either on site or near site, to then provide that hydrogen and potentially offer additional regional benefits by supplying volumes to others. But we also understand that based on the current state of the grid, the answer might be, yes, you can have that power, but you can't get it till 2032. And then we have to go and deliver some bad news to a customer. So an alternative, and what you'll see from our first two projects, is when we looked at how you produce green hydrogen, and before the hydrogen business model was a subsidy scheme, we looked at how as a business do we produce the lowest cost of green hydrogen. And when we looked at the economics, co-locating the generation with the renewable asset and then distributing that by road haul was the lowest cost of green hydrogen. The cost of distribution versus the cost of transmission, distribution, connection for the electricity was what that produced, and you will see that's the case. And then we used, working very closely with the haulage businesses, working with the trailer manufacturers, which is really refreshing, because I've got an industrial gases background. I used to work for one of the industrial gases majors. We used to work with hydrogen trailers day in, day out, large fleets, capacity around 300 kilograms. And when you start to look at projects of 10, 20 megawatts, that's a lot of trailers at 300 kilograms, lots of in and outs for the customer. When you're trying to replace something that comes out the end of a pipe, if it's an industrial customer today. So we've been really conscious of that, and now we're having conversations with those developers around large capacity, high pressure trailers, which reduces the impact on us, but also it makes it less invasive for the customer as well. We can start to think about delivering 1 ton of compressed hydrogen in a single trailer. It's really fundamental, and also has a large impact on the economics of those projects. And then on the right-hand side, you obviously have that utopian position where you've not only got your customer and your hydrogen generation, but you've also got the energy generation, the renewable energy generation all together, and you can produce that. So you're not relying on the grid. And there's things that can be done around that. Obviously, when you're having conversations, you can be working with a single off-taker, but you can be exploring on-site solar PV, have they explored wind turbines and other options as well. So just looking at that global hydrogen business roadmap, obviously across the industries, across the world, we're working with various industries, particularly, as I mentioned before, around refineries, fertilizer manufacturers, the chemicals industry. And the great thing about that is there's real opportunities in the UK for all of those. So we can take those global learnings and bring that as part of the experience. Really keen to see heavy transport, particularly around heavy road haul, and it's been great to have some conversations with different people today, looking at the refueling, looking at the vehicles, how they can sort of break this current process we're in to make it, to get some vehicles on the ground. But we're also actively involved in both passenger and freight rail opportunities, and then some of the larger stuff around maritime. We've got a development project over in the port of Felixstowe, down in the southeast. And obviously aviation, we're closely monitoring the SAF mandate. And for me, my role is around how do I make sure the business is ready for when those mandates come into place, so we can go to those industries and say, we knew this was coming and here we are, and we can deliver that product for you. Really, really important. And when we look at the first projects for Scottish Power, the Whiteley project and also the Cromarty project, heavily focused around the whisky distillery industry. Obviously quite Scotland-centric, but also as an industry, they've gone, we need to decarbonise. Our consumers will have, they will make purchasing decisions based on the greenness of our products, but also looking at export markets as well. What are going to be the limitations? What's the green footprint for our product? How does that restrict our ability to trade with the world, excluding stuff that's going on in the US and everything else, which is quite problematic probably for most industries. And then obviously I mentioned, but also they're talking upstream as well. So they're going to their suppliers. So they're talking to glass, they're talking to their maltsters, they're saying, it doesn't just, we've got to decarbonize what we do on our site and then how we distribute that downstream, but we need you to decarbonize as well. The shareholders, the industries, the consumers are saying we want to see this. And they're an industry that's really taken a grasp on this, to the point we've already got some distilleries using hydrogen, and we've got others that have actually made those changes so they're ready when that green hydrogen comes as well. So just to quickly touch on our global experience, we've got two live projects in Spain. We have a 20 megawatt industrial project with Fertiberia in Portillano, and that's a 20 megawatt electrolyzer that's feeding into a green ammonia plant for green fertilizer. And then in the port of Barcelona, we have a phase one, 2 megawatt on-site electrolyzer co-located with a refueling solution. And one of the key things around this is that was originally built to support a first fleet of hydrogen buses with TMB, Barcelona bus, basically. But as well as that, it's been able to support bin lorries, early HGVs. Some of that hydrogen has been exported to support train trials. And it's really important because that might be your base load customer, but that doesn't mean it's closed off for everybody else. We need to utilise these assets. The ambition is we maximise the potential, that we make that hydrogen available as much as possible. So obviously that's a real key message for the market. So coming on to the first two projects, we have our first project, our flagship project, which you may have not heard me talk about for a while, because for those that have been in the industry long enough know that the Whiteley Hydrogen Project has been in planning for about 4.5 years. I'm glad to say we were awarded in January. So fantastic step for us as a business, which means I can now tell you about all the benefits of Whiteley again and what it's doing. But also, like saying that planning process has now been done in Scotland. So when we go to talk to other planning authorities, when we talk to Scottish Government, there's something that can be used. I've made it very clear that I don't want it to take 4.5 years for any subsequent planning applications, but we understand that we were very early. We understand that the stakeholder engagement, working with the local authorities, let's not make the first thing we do is drop a pre-planning application on the door and say, there you go, we'd like that done in 19 weeks, please, because the answer will be no. But the engagement we've had on subsequent projects has been really, really encouraging, because they're now understanding what the benefits of hydrogen could be them for them as a local authority, but also because we're engaging earlier, we're talking about the benefits and everything as well. So Whiteley is a 10 megawatt co-located with the UK's largest onshore wind farm. It's 538 megawatts, which means that we get great high utilisation on that plant, but also, which is not always the case, it's actually close to a cluster of potential hydrogen offtake as well. So it's got great access. As part of the planning award, if you do look it up, you'll also notice that there was a solar PV plant and also battery electric storage as well. So that it's not dependent on that, but it can certainly utilize that. And it's also a great renewable energy flagship project to show people how those different technologies can come together to produce green hydrogen in this example. So that's really important. Obviously, we've been working really hard with supply chain, etc. So that project, now we've got planning. We also signed our LCHA, our low carbon hydrogen agreement, with UK government for both these projects in December. We were two of the three projects to sign our government contracts. So those projects will be going into FID middle of this year. When people say, can we come to Whiteley, we won't just be showing you a field in between two wind turbines in the future. We'll be showing you the building of a hydrogen plant. And the great thing about Whiteley as well, it's got a really large visitor centre. It's used every day by the members of the public to go walking, running, dog walking. So there's lots of the ability to actually see this develop over time as well and really get to see the benefits. And then just to touch on our second project, which is the Cromarty project. So that's a joint venture project with our partner Storegga. And that's at our Ben Tarzan wind farm, which is to the north of Inverness in a place close to Invergordon. Again, heavily focused around the distillery sector, obviously quite renowned for distilling in that region for various different reasons. But phase one of that plant will be 15 megawatts. So in the same instance, when we look at the design, how we would do it, there's lots of similarities, and it's just a modular build out from the original 10 megawatts that we've done for Whiteley. And again, that's contract signed. We're in the process of finalising off-taker agreements as we speak with those off-takers, and then we'll be heading towards FID in and around the same time, probably August, September time for the Cromarty project. But again, we'll be operational in 2027. And obviously, from the basis that they're co-located with the wind farms, we have the ability to build those out into hundreds of megawatts in scale over time as well, by utilising those. And that is pretty much me. Bit of a whirlwind tour. Appreciate it's great to be able to talk about these real projects now. I've been in conferences at the end of last year, particularly people who are looking at supply chain. How can we support these projects? How can we use the production from these projects? We've got two real life projects now that we hope to update you at in due course. And we're really keen to share that, and then we can talk about our future plans in time to go as well. But thanks very much for your time today, and I'm happy to join the panel session later. Thank you.
Yeah, thanks, Mark. I'm sure that when we get to the panel session, people will be interested to kind of get a little bit more insight into the learnings you've got from those projects. I'd now like to introduce Angus Paxton. He's head of gas and whole energy network development at NESO.
Thank you very much. Hello. Before I get started, please indulge me with a show of hands. Oh, we need to move on, I think. Have you got the clicker? Okay, thank you. Sorry. Please indulge me with a show of hands. Who here is already convinced? Oh, hang on. I'm too far. Who here is already convinced that Britain needs a national hydrogen backbone? Please raise your hands. Okay, so keep your hands raised, look around the room. Okay, that's most of you. And that probably means that I don't need to answer this question here and now. Now, please put your hands back up if you believe that the government thinks that we need a national hydrogen backbone. Oh, there's one person at the back, another couple of other people. That probably means that I need to be answering this question in Westminster, not here and now. As part of the run-up to this conference, the conference organisers were keen for me to answer three supplementary questions, although I could ask them, I'm not going to. What are the benefits of this backbone? What are the challenges? What are the potential alternatives? Now, I'm very sorry to disappoint, but I'm not going to answer these questions or that question today. Hopefully, though, I am going to shed some light on how NESO will be answering this question over the coming months, and I will hopefully leave you with some positive thoughts. Now, I'll take you through three things. Firstly, who NESO are. Secondly, how we're going to be doing the planning. And thirdly, those reasons to be hopeful. Hello, I'm Angus Paxton. I'm head of gas and whole energy network development at NESO. I look after the team that does gas network planning in NESO. I'm part of the Strategic Energy Planning Directorate, of which I'll talk more about in a little while. But firstly, just a little bit about NESO. We are independent, government-owned, we're free of profit as a motivation, and we're regulated by Ofgem. We were created by the Energy Act 2023. We came into being on the 1st of October last year. And we exist to operate the electricity system and to plan future energy networks. Our objectives, which are nailed down in primary legislation, are to ensure that the government can deliver a decarbonised energy system cost-effectively and securely. We bring together a number of activities that are necessary to deliver on those objectives. At the core of what we do, and this is where we've come from, is we operate the electricity system, we keep the lights on. We keep the lights on by keeping millions of spinning magnets spinning at exactly the same rate all across the country. We're literally spinning plates on sticks. Now, there's a whole bunch of planning, market design, systems development, connecting and contracting of assets that are required to ensure that we can always keep those lights on. The electricity system of the future will be increasingly inseparable from that whole energy system of the future. And so we are now also responsible for planning that energy system of the future. And the energy system of the future is way more complicated than the energy system of the past and of now. In the next slide, I want to talk you through how our planning activities are coming together. And in doing so, I hope to address the question I said at the start that, you know, I'm going to tell you how we're going to do this, providing you with some idea about how we're going to do it and whether or not we need a hydrogen backbone. Good, the animation's working. There are three primary outputs from the Strategic Energy Planning Directorate. Hopefully, these outputs begin to provide the choreography that Chris was hoping for this morning. Firstly, is the strategic Spatial Energy Plan, or SSEP. I'm going to throw lots of acronyms at you. Sorry. It currently takes about a decade and a half to build new electricity transmission systems. Most of that is planning. We need to accelerate this in order to deliver decarbonisation. The SSEP is focused on identifying where the different components of that future energy system are most economically located and that they are environmentally assessed so that we can prove through the planning process that the associated transmission infrastructure is needed. The final SSEP will be chosen by the Secretary of State, but NESO has been commissioned to produce a series of pathways that balance the economics alongside the environmental and societal impacts. The electricity market of the future might be dominated by the use of electrolyzers to produce hydrogen. Other hydrogen production technologies are available, and they may form part of the mix. Hydrogen itself is a vital commodity for some industries, and it's possibly an important energy vector in its own right. As such, the SSEP needs to look simultaneously at the needs of the electricity system and of the hydrogen system. These are likely to be inseparable markets because electrolyzers will often be used to balance the variable renewable generation. The SSEP is concerned with assessing the combined electricity and hydrogen energy system, and at its core, this is a really complex modelling exercise, which I'm happy to talk about in length and in detail, but not now, because you'll all fall asleep. We also need, as part of this, to balance the various different colours of hydrogen that have been talked about today. Now, the SSEP has been commissioned by the government, and they are responsible for providing and agreeing all of the assumptions that underpin it. We're working very closely with them to get it off the ground. It's not quick. The results of the SSEP will provide us with a clear need for the electricity network, and so it will be a vital component, a vital input into the next component, which is the Centralised Strategic Network Plan, or CSNP. Now, the CSNP may need to consider a wider set of assumptions, so may draw more on our future energy scenarios, which I hope you're all aware of. And this is important for other reasons, which I'll talk about in a moment. It's worth noting that at the moment, the FES and DESNZ assumptions are not always completely aligned, so we're working with government to understand how to align them more closely and to understand the differences, and I hope we can begin to align on things. Primarily, the CSNP will be focused on the engineering of the electricity network. It will assess the potential options for addressing the needs identified in the SSEP. And there's an awful lot of electricity network that we need to build, okay? So this is no small exercise. But it's the engineering. It also goes to look at the electricity network and how it behaves under various different conditions. But now, as NESO, we also have gas network planning duties, methane network planning duties, where we're responsible for planning the gas transmission network alongside NGT, National Gas Transmission. This is gas engineering. It's a different set of skills to the electricity network planning that we're doing. But it's broadly fulfilling the same function. And also in the vein of the CSNP is the need for us in the future, from next year, to start to plan the detail of the hydrogen network. This will be working out what the diameters of that network might be, working out the operating pressures, and that sort of thing. That's much more like methane gas and methane engineering than it is electricity engineering. So it'll be my team that will be doing that work. But there's also clearly a need for a clicker to work when I press it. Something's missing there. Clearly a need for some repurposing. The final major component of the strategic energy planning alphabet soup is the RESP, or the Regional Energy Strategic Plan. Now, we're trying to refer to this one as the RESP, because if we refer to it as the RESP, people want to say ETC or ECT on the end. Anyway, the focus of the RESP will be on the local and regional energy systems. We will work very closely with the local stakeholders, the local governments, the devolved administrations, etc., the gas distribution networks, the electricity distribution networks, and potential heat networks. Importantly, the RESP will be reliant on our FES work on the future energy scenarios, and it's this link that allows us to provides us with the ability to align that top-down approach to the bottom-up approach. Altogether, these parts of strategic energy planning provide the primary canvas on which our energy future will be painted, and it captures the primary interactions between the vectors and between the transmission and distribution systems. As you might imagine, all of this work involves a huge amount of stakeholder engagement. This is a massive challenge for Great Britain, and NESO wants to talk to Great Britain. So there's a huge amount of stakeholder engagement going to happen as part of this. Now, I'm conscious that that last slide was quite busy, and I have said quite a lot of words over it. Okay? I just want to refocus your attention on two key things from that last slide. Firstly, that the SSEP will look at the economics of a hydrogen system side by side with the economics of wires and batteries and where we put wind and solar, etc. And secondly, that the detail of what that hydrogen pipeline system looks like will be assessed in more detail by NESO's gas network planners and engineers. But a hydrogen pipeline system may also serve a vital purpose in providing security of supply to the emerging hydrogen sector. And so NESO may also need to consider this from a security perspective. The government have said in its recent strategy update that the details of our role in planning the hydrogen system will be consulted on in spring this year. So that will be out very soon, I think. Hopefully you can see now that we will be answering this question in the future, the main question in the future, and we will do so using a variety of different approaches. But even though most of you are already convinced of the need for a national hydrogen pipeline network, I fear my presentation might leave you a little unsatisfied. However, I do think there are reasons you can be optimistic. Numerous studies have shown some pretty good arguments for having that backbone. Often they show a north-to-south hydrogen vector, extra wind and electrolysis in Scotland, pipelines to storage in England, and then we burn it in, in turbines when we need to, when it's not windy, when it's not sunny. Most of these studies are based on some really complicated modelling that balances across all these various different components. And that takes an awful lot of computing power and an awful lot of brain power to get right. But they all rely on assumptions, and those assumptions into the future are uncertain. They can also be distorted, and the models have boundary limitations. You can't model everything. Many of the assumptions were locked into these studies some time ago, and so many of those forecasts that are embedded in there will have shifted. The costs of electrolyzers into the future, the costs of onshore wind, the costs of solar, these things are changing all the time. So some of these studies might need revision, but they are perhaps a reason to be hopeful. So, in the dying seconds, just to recap, NESO has been established to be the independent future energy system planner. We're well on the way to developing those plans, and hydrogen is in focus. And thirdly, the existing literature implies that we will need a backbone, but this needs to be independent and up to date. Thank you.
Thanks, Angus. I'd now like to introduce Annabel Sarling, Energy Certification Manager for the Low Carbon Contracts Company.
Thank you very much. Sorry. Hello. So lovely to be here today. I'm going to sort of hopefully bring a bit of different perspective on sort of the talks today, and hopefully sort of share some insights into how the UK hopes to enable the UK's low-carbon hydrogen economy. Thank you. Sorry, I think it's loading up now. Thank you. Here we are. So, how certification can provide confidence in the low-carbon hydrogen economy? Who knows what sort of certification is as a mechanism? Because I always like to describe it in food terms. I think it's sort of much easier and digestible. So, great taste is one of the really sort of famous ones, as is fair trade. And essentially, it's a single sort of point verification mechanism to show that a product has met a certain credentials, a certain set of credentials. Often these set of credentials have taken a while to develop and are sort of mutually agreed by experts in the industry. And in this case, the credentials we'll be talking about today is against the UK's low carbon hydrogen standard, which I believe a lot of you will have had interactions with at some point. So just a disclaimer before we begin, if people can sort of try not to take too many photos of the presentation, and always happy to sort of discuss later or sort of via email, LinkedIn, if you have any sort of more like detailed questions or would like any further information on what's being presented. So first of all, I'm obviously here with the Low Carbon Contracts Company. The Low Carbon Contracts Company is an independent organization, privately owned, with a single shareholder, the Secretary of State for the Department for Energy and Net Zero. And we have proudly been tasked with sort of mission, sort of very, very small mission of accelerating the delivery of the UK's net zero. And we've done so primarily through contracts for difference. Many of you know private law contracts, hydrogen allocation rounds, And also we are the settlement body for the capacity market. So sort of might be, I guess, slightly interesting why we're now speaking to you about certification. Certification meets and requires a lot of the same expertise that the low carbon contracts company has. It's essentially a mechanism for ensuring investor confidence in net zero and essentially really nascent markets that actually require sort of, I suppose, more hands-on support, but not necessarily the support that the government and industry can deliver alone. And the LCCC is, I suppose, sort of the perfect mechanism of sort of in between government and industry as a way of sort of harmonising the requirements for, I suppose, a nascent market to be able to operate freely, but with sort of clear investor confidence. So, low carbon hydrogen. As you all know, we have a net zero goal. And these sort of commitments are also not just tied to government agendas and manifestos. They're tied to sort of more international climate commitments and goals. And I think actually something and really sort of like unique about low carbon hydrogen and the way the certification scheme will view low carbon hydrogen is it won't be through colours. The idea is actually that the certification scheme will verify any hydrogen, so it can be green, blue, pink, purple, as long as it meets the emissions threshold. And the reason why this decision has been made is because I think being sort of technology agnostic in a really nascent industry is the type of support that the market deserves. I often refer to iPhones as kind of sort of how allegorical it will be to hopefully to hydrogen. I think the difference between the iPhone 1 and the iPhone 5 was huge. I don't think anyone could particularly anticipate the type of growth and the type of innovation that occurred in between 1 and 2. So I think that's one of the reasons why why sort of low carbon hydrogen will be the focus versus actually sort of looking at particular technology tracks. And I hope as well that that's a really sort of, I guess, secure signal to industry that, you know, even within the realms of, I suppose, additional verification, there's still a clear commitment to sort of maintaining innovation in innovation and support in a nascent industry. So hydrogen certification, it's essentially going to be a way for producers to verify and demonstrate the attributes of products. With this, the hope is that not only it can be used for sort of support mechanisms, ways for, I don't know, sort of showing investors or in context of, you know, potentially future like green taxonomy, FDI, that you're able to meet the emissions threshold. We also hope that industry will find its own uses for hydrogen certification, whether or not that's for sort of investment purposes or actually to build on the original sort of certification scheme and find new ways of using MRV practices to enable your sort of hydrogen supply chains. So a bit about the scheme background. At the moment, we are working with the government in an advisory capacity to develop the certification scheme. Some of you may be aware, and I'm not sure how familiar you are, but the European Union has its own version of a hydrogen certification scheme called Certify. That's sort of within its own sort of like trade block, and essentially the UK scheme will hopefully sort of achieve parity with the European Union's Certify scheme. So there is a really sort of, I suppose, strategic trade note to this scheme, and it's something that the government are really sort of cognizant on, and colleagues at DESNZ are currently working with European partners on sort of the development of how we can ensure that there's a mutual recognition framework around the certification scheme. That's not to say, though, that that's limited to the European Union. There have been previous COP pledges that have tied to wider mutual recognition frameworks for certification of hydrogen. So I think it's a really exciting and strategic role in the market, and hopefully it's something you all will sort of be engaging with or have actually already engaged with through, I suppose, sort of like outward looks and essentially we hope that it will sort of bridge a gap between what the European Union's doing and what the UK is doing. So yeah, I think it's a really exciting opportunity for the UK in general, but also hopefully as well will provide the right sort of support for export markets as well as import markets for low carbon hydrogen, because I think as well it's something that we're quite aware of isn't necessarily as sort of synced up as it could be at the moment. Sorry, that end should have been moved. It wasn't like that thing. But yeah, so how will, I suppose, certification actually work? And why is it going to be so, I suppose, sort of like supportive to the UK's low carbon hydrogen economy? Well, the LCCC as preferred delivery body will be, or has been actually, working on a really robust certification ledger and head-end system. The idea is that under a sort of like mass balance trading rules, which essentially means anything that you put into the system, so any credentials you show, any time you transport your hydrogen, any MRV that's required under the system will be all put onto a ledger. Once you've sort of input it onto the ledger, you'll receive a certificate, but the certificate will be tied to the hydrogen. So it's hopefully going to be this sort of like robust mass balance chain of custody that actually, I suppose, sort of creates and enables more and more confidence in the UK's in the UK's hydrogen economy. I'm not sure if you're aware as well of different approaches to chain of custodies, but using mass balance chain of custody is essentially seen to be a sort of best practice over book and claim. Because under a book and claim scheme, you can essentially just say, you know, I have this much hydrogen, and there we go, it's sort of done. It's your hydrogen isn't necessarily tied to the certificate. Whereas this, literally, essentially, no one actually owns the certificate. It's actually the hydrogen that owns the certificate. So we hope as well this will really encourage foreign direct investment into UK low carbon hydrogen as a whole. I think as companies look to sort of divest their portfolios, and as we also see increasing sort of prevalence of green taxonomy legislation, that actually will be sort of, I think there are sort of global mandates around sort of financial sector supporting low carbon commodities. Having a certification system which actually allows for really robust proof of low carbon credentials is going to be a really, really powerful tool for foreign direct investment in UK's sort of hydrogen. So I really believe anyway that this system and this approach is what's going to sort of be a huge enabler long term, especially when we have, I suppose at the moment it's potentially quite hard to see, but as the hydrogen market matures sort of, you know, well into 2050, having these type of systems in place will be completely vital in ensuring the UK's sort of competitive advantage. And we also believe as well, for industry, having these MRV practices sort of really early on actually will be a really huge enabler, just from the perspective of you'll be able to, I suppose, sort of interact with other schemes and with other MRV practices, whether or not it's to do with certification or just sort of more broadly proving low carbon credentials. So we also believe that this sort of like best practice around verification of credentials is going to be really sort of fundamental in, I suppose, actually sort of supporting the maturity of low carbon markets in general. And we have been contacted by Digital Europe on this practice, and we have also been speaking with European partners on sort of how this, I guess, approach to verification can be replicated and emulated throughout. So it's something that we're sort of spearheading in the UK, but we will be working with international partners on as well. So again, hopefully supporting the UK's competitive advantage for low carbon hydrogen production. So sort of, I suppose it's very brief, but yeah, the impact on the sector in general. I suppose what's so exciting about this is that we don't know long term what the impact will be. We don't know if it's going to sort of be something that actually is going to be emulated by the rest of the world, or if it's actually just going to be something that industry sort of sees and sort of takes to use for its own reporting purposes. essentially the government at the moment is looking at how it can layer mandates and layer the use of certification for as sort of a means of verification. So it could well be that it's used for green taxonomy. It could be that it's used to support SAF mandates. It could be that it's used for, and most likely will be used for international trade purposes. But I think what we need for the impact to be the most meaningful is buy-in and engagement from industry. Essentially, if it doesn't work for industry, it won't be, we won't be able to sort of use it for sort of multiple use cases. So hopefully this is an area that, as the government is sort of like looking at developing this scheme, we can have engagement from industry, and you're all here today. And yeah, it's a really exciting, I suppose, sort of way to mature a market. It's not often something, this type of support often isn't there in a nascent market. So I really look forward to hopefully engaging with you all on this, and do watch out for further government publications on the hydrogen certification scheme. I don't know if anyone has any questions, but I believe they'll be saved for the panel. So thank you all very much.
Thank you, Annabelle. Okay, I'd now like to introduce Colin Robinson, Business Development Manager for EVODES. Did I pronounce that? EVODES. Right, over to you, Colin.
Grand. Good afternoon, everyone. So I think the title of this presentation, how much water do you need anyway, is a question that we always ask our customers first. So our customers might come to us and say, can you build us a water treatment plant for a refinery, a hydrogen plant? And our first question is, yes, of course we can. How much water do you need? And I found that with green hydrogen projects, the variability of answers we get back from that question is quite a lot broader than, say, more established sectors like refineries. So I wanted to try and give some benchmarks and some rules of thumb to allow people to understand, so how much water do you need? EVODES, who are we and why are we here talking about hydrogen when we're a water company? So this is a little aerial shot of the port of Rotterdam. So we look after 2.5 million Dutch people for their drinking water in the southwest of the Netherlands. We also look after around 7 oil refineries, around 20 chemical plants, and other large industrial sites for their industrial water and their industrial wastewater. On the port of Rotterdam itself, I mentioned all those plants. You won't find a demineralized water plant on any of the refineries in Rotterdam. You won't find a demineralized water plant on any of the chemical plants in the port of Rotterdam, because they buy it from a network where we produce it centrally. So the whole of the port of Rotterdam is managed from two demon water plants that we own and operate, and we produce around 2,500 tons an hour of demon water. So when Shell came along and they made FID a couple of years ago on their green hydrogen project in Maasvlakte, 200 megawatt green hydrogen project, we were partners in the development of that project and in that project plan, and we have now installed a pipeline to the Maasvlakte, which will take our demon water along to that plant, and they'll make hydrogen from our water. And that pipeline has enough capacity for, say, about another 600 megawatts of green hydrogen production along on that site. So that's the kind of, that's why we've had to kind of get involved in this space. And just to overlay another diagram on the port of Rotterdam, these are all various hydrogen projects and CO2 pipelines and hydrogen pipelines. So what we're talking about here and doing in our industrial clusters, as we're all aware, the rest of Europe is doing it as well. So these are all of our customers. They're all now talking about hydrogen projects. So we've had to get, just as we did 50 years ago, we had to get very good at industrial water and high-pressure steam applications and demon water. We're now having to get very, very good at hydrogen production projects and what water is required for them. So just a little bit of context. So I've used the example of a 100 megawatt green hydrogen plant, just because the numbers are relatively easy. So just for context, so that means 100 megawatts of energy going into an electrolyzer. So I'm not going to get into the chemical equation of why that makes 2 tons of hydrogen, because I don't know how to. My colleague Vincent, who's a process engineer, did that calculation for me, but it was something to do with breaking bonds and moles and other bits and pieces. So our 100 megawatts of energy makes 2 tons of hydrogen. To make that 2 tons of hydrogen, you need 18 tons of water. Great, no problem. that 18 tons of water, to get the 18 tons of water to make the 2 tons of hydrogen, actually you need to put 20 tons or cubic meters. A cubic meter of water weighs a ton, which is very convenient. So we have to put 20 tons of water in. It goes round and round and round in the electrolyzer. And as it does that, some of that water kind of picks up metals and other bits of corrosion. So it corrodes your electrolyzer as it's going round. So we have to take 2 tons out every hour. So we put 20 in, we take 2 out, 18's left, that makes you 2 tons of hydrogen. Okay, so you can do the equation for your 100 megawatt plant. You say, oh, we need 18 tons of water an hour. Actually, you need at least 20, because 2 of it's going to be waste. That electrolyzer and the various compressors and other bits of plant are going to get hot and they're going to need to be cooled. So of your 100 megawatts that goes in, 20 megawatts of that needs to be cooled. And if you're doing that with water in an evaporative system, that needs around 30 tons an hour to go into the cooling loop. And that gets concentrated up and it produces a blowdown or a waste stream. So you have to put 30 tons an hour into your cooling system for your 100 megawatt electrolyzer. So we've already gone from 18 tons an hour in our chemical equation, and now we're sort of in the realms of actually it's 50 tons an hour we need to put into the site. That water needs to be a specific quality and you need to treat it, so you need to have a water treatment plant. That water treatment plant will lose some water in the process of treatment. So to get our 50 tons of water every hour, actually we need to put 62.5 tons into the front end of that treatment plant. So we've gone from needing 18 tons an hour in our chemical equation to actually needing 62.5 tons in reality. And those various processes make some waste streams as well. So as well as needing to put 62.5 tons an hour of water into the front end of our plant now spits out 25 tons an hour of waste product that we need to do something with. Can we put it straight in the river? Do we need to treat it? So we've got a waste flow as well to deal with. So that is it in a nutshell. That's how much water you really need. And that's scalable. So if you go from 100 megawatts to a gigawatt, multiply by everything by 10. Okay. Of course, it's not that simple. That is if you happen to have drinking water or fresh water, which is relatively easy to treat and quite an efficient, well-known process. If you're not allowed to use fresh water because you happen to be in a water-stressed part of the country, or the drinking water company doesn't have that capacity to give to you, and you might want to use a more exotic source like wastewater. Great, it's a lovely, sustainable way of using a waste stream. Say, can we take that wastewater from that treatment plant and can we use it to make hydrogen? Wouldn't that be wonderful? Yes, of course you can, but it's a much less efficient process to make demon water from a waste stream than it is from, say, a river or drinking water. And seawater desalination as well. Seawater is great, there's loads of it, but it's a very inefficient process to make good quality, good grade industrial water from seawater. So those treatment efficiencies just refers to the water treatment plant. So if you're using seawater desalination, your 100 megawatt green hydrogen plant, which isn't that big, you actually need 100 tons an hour of seawater to go into that site to be able to treat it and cool it and produce the hydrogen you need. Okay. So what are we doing about it? I want to talk through some of the areas of research and development that our teams are focusing on in order to kind of enable these green hydrogen projects hopefully to go ahead at the scale that they're planned for. And the first thing I want to talk about is water quality. So we've talked a little bit about water quantity, and that's great, but do you just take seawater and put it in your electrolyzer? Well, not quite. People talk about
deem in water, or demineralised water. Our electrolyser needs deem in water, but again, the water nerds amongst you will know that not all deem in water is made equal. This is one of various international standards for deem in water, and there's four different types. So we're already confused. So this is type 2 deem in water. We make 100 million tonnes of that every year. And it goes into high-pressure steam, it goes into power stations, it goes into chemical sites, and it's all wonderful. We make tons and tons of it. And the key kind of parameters in there is probably something like conductivity. It has to be less than 1 microsiemen per centimetre, was it? So that's the kind of the number of ions that are in the water that are going to react with the plant and cause damage. And the other interesting one is silica. You know, it has to be very, very low. So that's great. Okay, we can do that. So we know we can do that at huge scale. We do it at Botlek. Like I showed you the two plants we had in Rotterdam. The type 1 water there, that's reserved for kind of semiconductor industry and the pharmaceutical industry. Very, very ultra-pure water. So you see that conductivity figure comes down from less than 1 to less than 0.056. Now, that is the theoretical limit of conductivity of water. If all you've got in the water is hydrogens and oxygens, water molecules, that is how conductive it is. There's no ions at all in the semiconductor world. And we know we can make that water as well. So in the semiconductor space, we make maybe 500, 600 litres an hour on a specialist plant for making semiconductors. And then in the high-pressure steam world, we make hundreds of tons an hour for a chemical plant or a refinery. Green hydrogen has come along and said, we want type 1 water, but we want hundreds of tons an hour. And that's not actually really been done yet. So making that type 1 water reliably and at scale is a bit of an unknown. We're working on it. We'll get there. But it's nice to. There is a couple of kind of gigawatt scale projects, but it's nice to see that we're starting at 7.5, 10, 15 megawatt, where we can do that ultra pure water, and then we can scale up with the hydrogen plant over time. So we scale up that production, but it's all about kind of learning together and doing that research. Coolings, and so I put the cooling slide in there, and there's some water use in the cooling. Of course, not all hydrogen plants are planning to cool with water. Certainly when you get to 300-400 megawatts, that's going to be the most efficient way to do it. But that creates an environmental issue with your blowdown. What do you do with your blowdown? What do you do with your wastewater? Can you get enough water in to do the cooling, etc.? So one of our areas of research is can we improve the efficiency of cooling systems? It's a law of physics. If you want to cool, you want to take energy away, you've got to boil water enough, it goes into the atmosphere. You can't really use less water to do the same amount of cooling, or can you? If you waste less of it, yes, you can. So on the left, you see a traditional kind of cooling system where people put surface water, so cheap water, straight out of the river, bung it in the cooling system, put a load of chemicals in to stop it corroding and growing bacteria and all the rest of it. It goes round a few times, some water boils off, those chemicals get concentrated, and then you have to take them out of the system, and that's your blowdown, that's your waste stream. You put that into the river, and then along comes the Environment Agency and says, you can't put that in the river anymore because it's bad for the fish. So we said, what if we used really, really expensive water? What if we used deem in water in the cooling tower? Well, the first thing is we didn't need to add all these chemicals. The second thing is we actually got that water to go round and round in the cooling tower 25 times before we needed to blow it down. So the blowdown was reduced by 83% compared to a traditional cooling system. And the overall water consumption of the cooling process was around 17% less by using deem in water. And that included the inefficiency of the deem in treatment process as well. So you can cool with less water and produce a lot blow down, but it's an area of research. I think we've got a 1 megawatt pilot plant running on that currently in Rotterdam. So, but interesting. what else are we working on? So, cooling towers, they produce this blow down, and it typically goes to waste. And people say, well, can we reuse it? It looks pretty clean, but it's got all those chemicals in it. So, we have got a pilot plant running at the minute where we're trying to see whether blow down from cooling towers on industrial sites can actually be reused as industrial water to feed an electrolyzer or do something else. So, it's challenging and it changes on a daily basis, but yeah, we have produced some water at industrial grade from cooling tower blowdown. And I think that plant is sized for around 100 meters cubed an hour. We're using about half the capacity at the minute, so good volumes through it as well. This is an area of research, and one of my colleagues is working on this alongside Alfa Laval. I don't know if Alfa Laval are in the room today, but this is one of their, they do waste heat distillation. And this is an ancient technology for producing water. Ships use it, and the waste heat from the ship's engine desalinates seawater, and then if you're on a cruise, you can flush your toilet, have a shower, and then that's wonderful. We are wondering, well, Alfa Laval are wondering, and we're trying to help them figure it out, whether there's enough waste heat that comes out of an electrolyzer and the compressors and other various bits. Is there enough waste heat to put through one of their plants to distill seawater or effluent to produce enough demon water to keep the electrolyzer running? We don't know yet. But it could be interesting. So the waste heat of the electrolyzer is actually doing the water treatment process to keep it running. I don't know the answer yet, but it's interesting. And lots of other sort of alternative water sources as well. So this is a map of water scarcity or forecast future water scarcity. The color scale is obvious. The darker the red, the scarier it is. So we're certainly not immune from water stress in parts of England, but you can see there in the northwest of Europe, particularly from our perspective and the Netherlands, why we started concerned about water availability and looking into alternative sources of water. So things like water reuse, so can we take sewage and turn it into industrial grade water? There are some parts of the world that take sewage, turn it back into drinking water. We're not quite there yet in Europe, I don't think, and England, I don't think we can stomach it, but certainly from industrial use, that's fine, right? We know that works. We do it on a large scale in the Netherlands, around about 250 meters cubed an hour from sewage. We treat the sewage and we treat the water, and then we supply it to industry. Seawater, we did have a seawater desalination plant. We actually took it out and put a wastewater reuse plant in because the wastewater reuse was more efficient than the seawater desalination. But we're looking at putting a desalination plant back in. Again, desalination, it's well understood. There's desalination plants all over the world. You go to Australia, you can go to Spain, you can go to the Middle East, they've got desalination plants. But to go for desalination to drinking water, as opposed to going from desalinated seawater to ultra-pure demon water is two different things. And also, we're trying to desalinate the North Sea. We're not trying to desalinate the Red Sea. The Red Sea is lovely. It's 25 degrees. You can put that through membranes and all sorts. It's fine. You take water out of the North Sea in December at -1 degrees Celsius and put it into a desalination plant. You take all the salt out. You've now got water without salt in it at -1 degree, and it will turn to ice inside your machine, and it will destroy it. So you have to heat that water up. So that 100 meters cubed an hour of seawater you needed to put in, you need to raise its temperature by, you know, maybe 10 degrees before you can actually desalinate it. And that's a huge amount of energy. We're trying to get our heads around it. We really are. So just a little summary. Yeah, the overall water balance of your site should, you know, consider cooling efficiency, water treatment, wastewater treatment, you know, take all that into account. Don't just look at the chemical equation. Feed water quality is crucial. You know, we need to work with yourself and your electrolyzer, your OEM for your electrolyzer as well, on what that water quality needs to be. What are the kind of scaling and fouling factors inside the electrolyzer that we really need to be worried about? And let's get that treatment optimized so that it can then be scaled. If you're planning a project in a stressed or an environmentally sensitive area, then you know we need to think about what technologies can be deployed. You might be starting small and running off drinking water, and that's acceptable to the environment. But if you want to scale that plant up, is the plant still appropriate for an alternative water source, or do I actually need to rip it out and start again? So thinking about how you're scaling, where you're scaling, what technology you're using, all of these kind of factor into how you plan for developing your water treatment on site as well. So that's me. Hopefully I haven't kept us from the drinks reception too long.
Are we all sitting comfortably? Right, okay. Right, does anybody... Oh, there are questions already. Okay, great.
No, so thank you so much. And I love that you said blockchain. It is essentially a form of blockchain. LCCC actually is really proud to have undergone its biggest procurement and is now working with partners Critical Software and LAN to build this. So we call it distributed ledger. It's a sort of form of blockchain, or blockchain is a form of distributed ledger. It essentially does remove people, and that's why we're sort of, I suppose, so proud of it as a system, and why Digital Europe has been in contact with the LCCC over sort of its approach. It's very, very much based on MRV. The idea is that there won't be sort of, I don't know, potentially like the RTFO has, masses of people behind the system. Essentially, it will be, you know, you sort of have to input your data against a really robust MRV criteria, and then that sort of will be passed through the system through equal inputs to equal outputs. But I suppose just to draw it back to what I was sort of saying about mass balance, this really enhances the UK's mass balance approach to hydrogen certification. Mass balance literally means, like I said before, that the chain of custody is, and then sort of the hydrogen is tied to a certificate. And yes, like you say, that is for blockchain systems. So I think as a result as well, we hope that the use cases for certification will be quite clear to financial sectors interested as well in looking at sort of how they deal with decarbonizing commodities. So no, thank you very much, good question. And in terms of not hearing about LCCC, I suppose it's... probably maybe sort of like Sandhurst helpers. That's what we've been doing sort of with the market. And all credit to producers, I think, always as well, is probably one of LCCC's mottos. So that's probably why.
Thanks. Any other questions?
Likewise, I can probably do without a mic, but this was for Angus, although given the flavour of your presentation, I imagine I know where the answer is going to go. last week, Hydrogen UK produced a series of 14 recommendations, one of which very heavily lent towards the idea of a hydrogen backbone. Given NESO can take the credit for making such rapid changes to the grid structure, how long is it going to take before we can see responses or ideally implementations of the other recommendations that came through, as all of those were set about trying to reduce the cost of hydrogen?
You'll need to forgive me because I don't know the recommendations that Hydrogen UK have put forward. I'd say, just in response to the backbone and how quickly we can get our plans out, the plan is that we will be doing the majority of the modelling on the SSEP will be done this year. We'll produce a series of pathways that go to the Secretary of State. Secretary of State will make a decision on which pathway he wants to go for. And then we go through a process of doing the environmental assessment on that, the societal assessment. And the SSEP will then come out in 2026, late in 2026. That then feeds into the CSNP, and the more detailed plan will then come out in 2027. Hope that answers your question. Yep.
There was a question on that side.
Sorry, Angus, it's another question for you, I'm afraid, but it's following on, I think, from what you just answered, is that, you know, my understanding is that the likes of National Gas and indeed Cadent have already spent quite a lot of time, effort and money on planning their own hydrogen pipeline routes based on supply and demand. So I was curious to know what influence your work will have on them.
That's a really good question. Yes, they have. They've been merrily, busily working away on and the various different gas networks have. It's not just NGT, but the gas distribution networks have been looking at this as well. They've been out there talking to stakeholders, trying to establish the level of demand that could be there, and planning networks to supply that demand. I think what isn't particularly clear is the economic needs case for a national hydrogen backbone. And that's very much embedded into the SSEP, and that needs to answer that question. The responsibility for the business models around hydrogen transport remain with DESNZ, and it'll be the government that will be making the decisions about who gets funded for what. I hope that answers your question, sort of.
Hi, Angus. I'm sorry, it's a question for you as well. I'm Kimberly Banko. I work for Northern Gas Network, so we're literally developing a 100% hydro network in the northeast. We've finalized pre-FEED. We're looking to move into FEED. Obviously, we have all these different bodies that we're engaging with, NESO, DESNZ. My question is, with the SSEP plan and depending the route, or the scenario that the government has to go through, how is that going to marry with the hydrogen transport business models that will be chosen? Because some of them might be ahead of the SSEP, so how will kind of juggle that? Well, the SSEP same, but versus the kind of commercial business models?
Yeah, it's a really good question. It's a question that I've got as well, so I'm really looking forward to the consultation that the government will be putting out this spring. I think there's an opportunity there to discuss how that all sits together.
Hi, Angus. A related question. Apologies for pinning you down. There's a lot of work going on at the moment looking at networks, like we've heard about HyNet today, ourselves on East Coast Hydrogen Project Union, some of the producers looking at their smaller networks, and that's happening now. You're not going to kind of start in anger till 2026 or the end of 2026 before you've got your kind of first plan. Basically, are you going to be kind of supporting industry, and or are you going to be prescribing what we should do? What should we be doing? Do we throw those works away in 2026 and start again?
The way it stands at the moment is that the government is responsible for the for doling out the money, if you like, to those business models, to the transport and storage models. So the individual projects will be planning those systems, and they'll be going to government and asking for that money, and it's the government's decision to grant that money or not, and therefore the networks can get on with building things. I know there is an urgency, there is a need to do these things relatively quickly. Ofgem have already, in the sector-specific methodology, said that, you know, hydrogen won't be funded through RIIO-3. So it's very much about the DESNZ decisions on that hydrogen transport and storage model, which will determine how quickly these things go through. The planning work that we're doing is looking beyond that shorter term horizon. We're looking at that longer term strategic need for a national hydrogen backbone. So there's that kind of top-down approach which needs to have that very long-term look at where we go to, how we're going to get to 2050, as well as the more immediate and bottom-up build, which is, at the moment, government.
Thanks. Jorge Arismendi from Kent, and again, the question is for Angus. It's a very popular topic.
It's all right. I've got some questions for the other ones.
So. Yes, we will have time. Yeah, the planning for infrastructure is heavily based on the future energy scenarios, and there is a lot of uncertainty on those because based on the assumptions, we are trying to predict what's going to happen in terms of supply and demand for the next decades. So a lot of them is just it's difficult really to predict because there might be some scenarios like Trump 2.0. Who knows what's going to happen next? Maybe COVID 2.0, Elon Musk 1.0, something like that that we don't really know. That's not really part of the future energy scenarios. And anyway, it's based on some assumptions for demand, for supply. How do you reconcile those to plan for? Infrastructure is pretty much planning focus on non-regret decisions such as the hydrogen backbone, and then future planning would depend on how the economy moves on.
Yeah, okay, so a little bit of history, if you like, first is that the future energy scenarios were originally designed when ESO was part of National Grid, to express a range of potential different outcomes. The FES 24 publication last year actually shifted. We moved from looking at a range of different outcomes to actually just some credible net zero compliant pathways that actually are quite similar. So it's a bit of a shift. A counterfactual was included essentially for planning the gas networks. FES 25 will be coming out, so in 2025 there will be a new FES or an update to FES 24 that will be published. The SSEP, however, will be based on DESNZ assumptions. It'll be based on government assumptions, so it's a slightly different thing. In doing the SSEP, we are going to have to explore a lot of different uncertainties in some of the input assumptions, and that's very much embedded into the methodology and what we'll be doing. But nobody could predict that Donald Trump was going to turn Gaza into a beach resort, which is apparently what he said yesterday. Yes, there's lots of geopolitical uncertainty in this space. I'm not quite sure how we handle it, but I think we've got a British focus on that SCP.
I think there was a question. There's a couple of questions at the back. Three now.
Thank you. Imad from the Water Research Centre. Slightly different question, actually. There's quite a lot going on in the hydrogen space, and I want to bring the panel to think with us. What are the key priorities in terms of innovation when it comes to hydrogen and water? Can you share with us some key lists where we should focus our innovation? Thank you.
Is that me? I think the biggest challenge that we see is getting to the final water quality that the electrolyzer needs to operate efficiently. We've got no view of kind of warranties and things that OEMs put on these things, but we assume they're quite hefty, and this is a big investment. So, particularly where people want to use exotic water sources. So, like I said, that final water quality that goes in that we make at the minute that goes into kind of steam systems. If there's variability in the final water quality because the feed waters off spec, somebody's put something in the river, or it's a cold day, or it's a wet day, or all sorts of things can happen. That slight variability in the final water quality doesn't really matter so much. A steam turbine will still turn it into steam, but it could really damage an electrolyzer. And even to the point where any impurities might clog membranes, PEM membranes, and then you've got hydrogen molecules going into oxygen tanks, and that's not good. So I think reliably guaranteeing that the final water quality going into the electrolyzer is at the quality required, that's something we see as a huge challenge. And where the liability for that sits.
Okay, I think there was a couple more at the back.
Mike Kensteri, Progressive Energy. Question for Annabelle. So the criteria for getting a low carbon hydrogen certificate, it's the low carbon hydrogen standard criteria, so it's the same criteria that you'd need to claim support under the LCHA. Will it be possible to use your certificates to evidence compliance for the purposes of LCHA support?
So at the moment, we're sort of still looking into that, and I think actually if that is something industry would support, then I would definitely voice that to the department. Then perfect. But I do think eventually that is the intention. I think LCCC, from an operational perspective, can see a lot of reasons why that would be really valuable. But it sort of wouldn't confirm yet.
Charles Perestori, Progressive Energy. This wasn't coordinated with Mike, so it's also a certification question, though, but thought of entirely independently, I assure you. In the blending consultation and strategic decision of 2023, there was a chapter question on certification, and DESNZ's initial view was not minded to enable certificate trading of hydrogen, and in general, I guess, industry's response was, think again, this would be beneficial for enabling distributed market development, enabling, you know, consistent with all the roles of blending as a market enabler. You can think of it in terms of the clean power mission. If you've got distributed gas engines, gas turbines, smaller dispatchable power around the place, those aren't necessarily located in clusters that can get a direct pipeline access of hydrogen economically. But blending into the gas network and trading of certificates could enable them to buy low carbon gas in exactly the same way that green hydrogen can buy renewable electricity across the grid, and do that, you know, with the REGOs, et cetera, that's well established in the electricity market. And those dispatchable power plants could then contract for low carbon gas, produce low carbon electricity, and contribute to clean power 2030. So I just wanted to clarify, based on what you described, Annabelle, in your presentation around the mass balance custody transfer of what you described basically about the certificates, was that in contradiction to enabling that market arrangements? If so, do you have any thoughts on that in terms of contributing to clean power, enabling distributed industry to decarbonize and distributed power to decarbonize as well? Thank you.
Thank you for your question, and I'm really aware of sort of the blending, I suppose, sort of issue at the moment and sort of the way it's been looked at. What I would say is, first of all, is mass balance is an approach to a chain of custody, so it's sort of very much a grounding sort of principle and a way of operating the scheme versus necessarily being targeted at, I suppose, sort of like different technology approaches, etc. But on blending, I think the government did, and DESNZ did definitely sort of listen to industry, and I think another consultation on blending is sort of due to come out. What I would say in general is that one of the, I suppose, sort of powers of certification in the future, we hope anyway, is that there will be many use cases for the certificates. I think those sort of, one of the, I guess, like challenges, and something that I really would encourage industry to do is engage on actually how the certification scheme can be useful. So what I think as well the LCCC as an independent organisation is really interested in is actually seeing how we can use this operational capability to apply it to other areas of the hydrogen market. So even if it's not necessarily sort of use case within this specific certification scheme, can there be other certification schemes that can enable other parts of the hydrogen economy that this one doesn't normally sort of necessarily cater for? Is something as an independent organisation we're really interested in exploring. So yeah, I hope that sort of gives a bit of a response or no.
Yeah, I guess just building on that, the wider use cases, have you considered, obviously it's not hydrogen, but biomethane is a low carbon gas that could fulfill the same role as blended hydrogen in terms of the distributed power that I mentioned, and whether there's a unified certification scheme for low carbon gases, so it's then not, you know, it's agnostic between hydrogen or biomethane, or you have equivalent provisions for the CO2s per the emissions intensity that could then both of those gases or some of the other production technologies that were discussed in I think session two earlier today that can enable a wider market for the same kind of roles, and whether you see that being relevant. It's also relevant to the GSO consultation that was come out recently and had a webinar yesterday around whether there's a application for taxing the GSO according to carbon intensity of the gases that go into the network, so that again you know they're talking about exemptions for hydrogen and for biomethane, but you could then have a different level of GSO according to whether it's LNG, UK continental shelf, and obviously lower carbon gases having a lower tax, which then provides the market signals and incentives to move towards a functioning, let capitalism do its work, as one of the speakers said earlier, which is ultimately what government wants, because it wants to reduce the subsidies and stop having a state design system, but a market responding system that will then give you all the efficiencies that government wants. So just any further thoughts on that?
Yeah, so I think as a delivery body, like I sort of said before, we're really, really interested in being able to sort of actually achieve economies of scale. Like I sort of said in response to a previous question, we've undertaken is sort of our biggest procurement ever. And actually, because the sort of system that we've developed is so intricate and actually sort of has, I guess, like kind of one of the most advanced approaches to mass balance of chain of custody, you can sort of switch on and switch off those sort of components, but also because it's based on MRV and sort of really rigorous MRV inputs and outputs, actually they can be applied to lots of sort of different technologies. And I think, no, absolutely, we would encourage that. What I would say is for the sort of case of low carbon hydrogen certification, the MRV requirements will be set through the LCHS, and for, I suppose, that specific type of certificate, it absolutely will be set, but that's because that's the sort of value of having certification as sort of a verifiable source in general. But that's, no, I sort of completely agree with you that there are sort of plethora of use cases for plethora of technologies that will be sort of, have various different sort of strategic influences to our net zero journey. And I think it's absolutely something we will be looking at and are looking at as other sort of like use cases for certificates and other sort of types of certification schemes.
Thanks.
Dare I ask if there's any more questions? Okay. I do have some questions, but I'm not going to stand in the way of the networking drinks. So I'm going to wrap it all up. And if anybody else has other questions, they obviously can speak to the panelists at the networking. But I'd like to say, just to wrap up, thank you very much to the audience. You've been really engaging throughout the whole day and with some great questions. So thank you much for staying with us throughout the day. Thanks to the panelists for some great closing presentations for the day. Some really interesting stuff presented. And thanks to the organisers for giving me the opportunity to host and be your host for the day. So thank you, everybody. If you can show your appreciation to the presenters, that'd be great. Are the drinks downstairs in the exhibition centre? Right, okay. Off you go.